Next case is Amir Hekmati versus the United States, 2021-2086. Ms. Grimm, please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Emily Grimm, counsel for appellant Amir Hekmati. Your Honor, the issue before you today is whether the trial court erred in dismissing Mr. Hekmati's claim for lack of subject matter jurisdiction under the Tucker Act. As you know, the claim arises from the government's failure to pay an award issued to Mr. Hekmati by the U.S. Victims of State-Sponsored Terrorism Fund in 2017. Mr. Hekmati has asserted that the government's reconsideration of the award violated the fund's authorizing statute, and his claim seeks the roughly $2 million the fund has failed to pay him to date, as well as any future payments to which he would have been entitled.
Grimm, to get to the heart of the matter quickly here, are you contending that the special master lacks any authority to reconsider one of his or her decisions?
I think that's right, Your Honor.
Can't reconsider at all, no matter what. If the day after the decision, the special master discovers that there's a problem with the decision, that does not have the power to reconsider it?
Well, we can certainly get into the merits of the reconsideration.
Where I'm going with this, of course, is there is a broad line of cases saying that administrative agencies have the inherent authority to reconsider their decisions. They don't need to have express statutory or regulatory authority to do so. That being the case, why isn't this best viewed as a case in which the special master, having made a decision, later reconsidered the decision and denied relief? And so the case as it comes to the Court of Federal Claims is a denial of relief, which is not judicially reviewable. Why isn't that the correct way to review the case?
Sure. And we did brief this on the merits down below. So I think the reason why the special master is not entitled to reconsider is threefold. You are correct that there is a broad line of cases saying that the government has inherent authority to reconsider its decisions in the administrative context, but there are limits on that. And the three limits are when the statute expressly precludes that review, when the reconsideration doesn't take place within a reasonable time, and if the decision or process was otherwise arbitrary and capricious. And so in our briefing below, we did get into detail about why all three of those prongs were met. The first being that the USVSST Act, which I'll probably just refer to as the Act, as that's a little bit of a mouthful, expressly states that all decisions by the special master are final and non-reviewable.
Well, non-reviewable is very different from non-reconsiderable. And if your interpretation of the statute is that it's not reviewable, if that means that, again, to take my example, the day after a decision, the special master discovers that in his decision he wrote is compensated and should have said not compensated, that he can't change that. That's not really your position, is it?
I think that goes to the second prong of the test, and that is timeliness.
Take care of the first prong first. You're not really saying that the Act prohibits reconsideration, correct?
If the case were here that the special master reconsidered Mr. Hekmati's claim because it discovered an administrative error the day after it issued his decision, then I think we would be looking at an analysis of whether that falls within the standard or whether reconsideration is appropriate. But on the facts of this case, which is what I can speak to, I think that the timing of the reconsideration, which was the years after his initial decision was issued, and at least based on what we know, 11 months after the information was provided to the fund that was cited as the basis for the reconsideration, that very clearly does not fall within the standard of a timely reconsideration. And I think timeliness is important because if you have a fund where claimants are being paid pro rata, so everybody's payment depends on the next individual, there needs to be an element of finality so that those payments can be made timely and the fund can be an administered. Otherwise,
the basis for the special master's reconsideration was a finding of fraud. And isn't it the case that where fraud is present, that concerns about timing are much less important? That is to say, if the plaintiff has done something to get a judgment that is based on fraud, then it seems that the cases seem to suggest that any concerns about timeliness are much less compelling. And here, if I understand the timing, I thought that the approval of the claim came in December of 2018, and then the department announced that it was seeking reconsideration in October of 2019. So it's really only 10 months between the time of the approval of the claim and the decision to seek reconsideration. Do I have the timing right?
I believe the initial, and I can briefly look at my notes to confirm this, but I believe the initial eligibility determination was in late 2017.
That's correct.
The special master's
approval of the claim was, I think, December 13th, 2018.
Right. The letter saying you are entitled to receive $839,000, which will be issued sometime in the next year. That's right.
And 10 months later, the Department of Justice said we're seeking reconsideration, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
And to answer your question about whether the limitations on reconsideration go out the window when allegations of fraud are at issue, I think the answer is those limitations still exist. I believe the cases we cited in our briefs before the trial court, in the Tokyo case, I believe fraud was alleged, if I'm remembering correctly, and that is the very case where the court laid out the standard for all of those limitations on reconsideration. And so I don't think that the cases say that the standard goes out the window when fraud has been alleged by the government.
Okay.
So if it would be useful to the court, I can plan on briefly addressing the trial court's two grounds for holding that it lacked jurisdiction and why the court.
Can I just ask you one quick question before you move off of this line?
Of course.
Why would 10 months be unreasonable? You just kind of walked through the timeline with Judge Bryson. I want to understand from you why 10 months seems unreasonably long.
Sure. So I think if you look at the spectrum of cases of determining what is not timely, there are several cases that say we're talking about weeks being reasonable and not months. The timeline was as follows. The special master deemed Mr. Hekmati eligible in December of 2017. In December of 2018, he said, the fund has money. You will be receiving your first payment of $839,000 soon. The fund then paid all eligible claimants except Mr. Hekmati in January, so within several weeks, and declined to answer any of Mr. Hekmati's calls by counsel. Members of Congress were inquiring as to what the holdup was, and the only information that we received was, well, payments are still being made, and eventually just nothing at all. And so really, the first time we heard something from the government was 11 months later, when there had been a report published in Congress saying essentially everyone has been paid. Counsel wrote to the fund saying, we don't understand what's going on here. We've been calling you for 11 months. We've received no information whatsoever. And frankly, Mr. Hekmati is out of options and is going to have to file legal action to compel this payment if we don't hear from you. And it was only 13 days after that that DOJ said, we're reconsidering and we're putting a freeze on your payment. And so looking at the case law that we cited to the court below, again, it was more than days, it was more than weeks, it was close to a year. Now, had it been perhaps, I think the record also shows that the information that was used as the basis for the reconsideration was within the fund's possession back in January. Otherwise, why would they have not paid him? Why would they have put a hold on his payment for that long? And so, under the case law, it just seems that 11 months of sitting on that information and then doing nothing about it until the claimant says, I have nothing, I have no other recourse here except to sue you, and then reconsidering, that to us does not seem to fit within permissible reconsideration under the case law.
Now, you mentioned the Tokyo case as being a case that incorporated some kind of requirement of reasonable action. As I recall, looking at it, I think this is right, that the reasonable time in the Tokyo case was reasonable time after learning of information indicating that the decision may have been tainted by fraud, but not a requirement of reasonable action prior to the time of learning of information that it's tainted by fraud. Is that consistent with your understanding?
I think that's consistent with my understanding, and I would say here, the fund had in its possession, based on the information we have obtained to date, as of January 2019. And so there was an 11-month lag between when the fund had the relevant information and when the reconsideration was commenced.
How do we know that the fund had the information that was necessary to change its mind about the payment?
Because they paid every other claimant except Mr. Hekmati.
And so it would have been simply because they had reason to believe that there might be some kind of problem, but they needed to investigate further, correct?
Then I would say that they had information or reason to believe that perhaps a reconsideration was warranted and that that would have started the clock. And frankly, this is the type, you are correct, this is exactly the type of information we would seek during discovery in determining whether this reconsideration really falls within what is appropriate under the standard. It's hard to do that in a vacuum, in a black box, but as far as we can see, there was no other reason for them to delay his payment by 11 months unless it already had some sort of information that was causing it to consider, decide whether it needed to reconsider his case.
Counsel, you're well into your rebuttal time. You can continue or save it.
I will just state briefly that with respect to the jurisdictional arguments, as we covered in our brief, the problem with both grounds the court relied upon in dismissing for subject matter jurisdiction is that they're based on the premise that Mr. Hekmati is seeking a review of a compensation decision by the special master, and that's not what's happening here. The special master made his compensation decision when he found Mr. Hekmati eligible in 2017. That decision was final and non-reviewable, and Mr. Hekmati has never challenged it. It is the government who has sought reconsideration of that decision years after it was issued, and it's that unauthorized reconsideration that forms the basis for Mr. Hekmati's claim, a claim that was filed well before the special master even began the reconsideration process.
So you are seeking review of the reconsideration decision, is that what you just indicated?
Not the outcome of the decision, the fact that he reconsidered at all. Our position is that the special master had no authority to reconsider to begin with, and the government had no authority to seek reconsideration in these circumstances pursuant to the act.
Thank you, Ms. Grimm. Ms. Rose?
Thank you, Your Honors. Can you hear me?
Yeah, oh yes.
May it please the court. I would like to start with the court's decision on jurisdiction, because here, while we do believe that if the reconsideration decision were before the court, we would prevail on the merits there. The trial court properly found that the USBSSP Act does not provide a cause of action for damages. In creating a discretionary benefits program like this, where Congress created a fund to compensate victims of terrorist acts committed by other sovereign nations, it was under no obligation to create a remedy in court, and it did not.
Let me ask you a question. Suppose instead of the facts of this case, that the special master had actually issued an award and not reconsidered the award, but the Secretary of the Treasury decided not to cut a check in that amount because the Secretary of the Treasury believed that there was something fishy about Mr. Hekmati's request. Would a challenge to the Secretary of the Treasury's decision not to pay be reviewable by the Court of Federal Claims?
Your Honor, that is an interesting hypothetical here, though.
Well, I'd like to know the answer to it. So I think it may be, but what's your answer?
I believe we need to go back to the Act and whether or not the Act creates a cause of action for damages based on violations of the Act. And here it does not, and I believe that that is what Forums, Arrogant, Fausto, and the like stand for. So in that circumstance, certainly there may be other avenues that a claimant might pursue that seems perhaps a failure of process, of constitutional due process, or potentially the claimant may need to petition Congress. Certainly in that circumstance, DOJ and the special master might get involved too, because they would have, if they believe that the claimant was eligible, they would not want someone outside of the agency and outside of the program meddling with that decision. But as the court said in Erica, the touchstone is the language of the Act, and the Act does not provide a cause of action to applicants, happy or otherwise, for review in the court. And it's been long recognized that where Congress creates such discretionary programs, it's under no obligation to provide a remedy in court, and here it did not.
What is your response to opposing counsel's argument that there was unreasonable delay in reconsidering the first decision?
Your Honor, Judge Bryson stated it correctly that the Tokyo decision states that the reconsideration must be within a reasonable time where there is fraud or the concern of fraud on the original decision within learning of that information. Here, the special master and the department were in uncharted waters where they learned that there may have been an eligibility determination that was based on fraud. And so there were really two aspects of that. First of all, the information that was available was classified. And so they had to make determinations about how reconsideration could be achieved in that circumstance. What they decided to do was declassify a record that they would make available to both the special master and Mr. Hekmati. So Mr. Hekmati had the full record that special master had access to, and that takes some time. And I would say also that they were very careful and seeking to correctly determine whether or not the special master here in a question that was posed to it before the very first time had the authority to reconsider and reopen his initial decision in this circumstance. And they found it, we believe correctly, that the special master does.
That's the issue, as your opposing counsel sees it, whether the special master had a right to withdraw his determination rather than whether Mr. Hekmati had a right to judicial review.
Yes, Your Honor. However, when determining whether or not the Tucker Act can be superimposed over in determining whether or not an act contains a comprehensive remedial scheme, the court does not look to a plaintiff's characterization of their claim, but instead looks at what is the claim at its root. And you see this in, for example, the Biltmore and Folden line of cases. Here, what is this claim at its root? A disagreement with the special master's determination that Mr. Hekmati is not eligible to receive compensation from the fund. And that is precisely what Congress said the court should not look into. and where I believe Worms would teach us that superimposing a Tucker Act general remedy on that specific and comprehensive remedial scheme, which was no less specific and comprehensive by being a short and compact act, would be interfering with Congress's intended liability under the act.
Anything further, Ms. Rose?
No, Your Honors. If the court does not have any further questions, we rest on our arguments today and in our brief. Thank you.
No one loses points by not using up all their arguments. Ms. Grimm has some rebuttal time, though.
Thank you, Your Honor. I did want to speak briefly to opposing counsel's point regarding Tucker Act preemption, and that is that the cases that the government and the trial court relied upon found that Tucker Act jurisdiction was preempted only when the relevant statute or its legislative history unambiguously provided an exclusive remedial scheme. And here, the Act's remedial framework addresses only instances where the claimant is challenging the special master's eligibility determination and the amount that it was awarded. There is no framework for addressing failure to pay an award that's already been adjudicated, unauthorized reconsideration of a final award, or really any other violations of the Act by the government. And so we do see that as a flaw in the logic there. I'm also happy to provide the cases I referenced regarding what is a reasonable amount of time, finding that an 11th month lag or something similar is untimely. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The case is submitted.